Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Jalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from struggles for liberation from all around the world. Welcome.
Hi, today I'm talking to Eric A. Stanley about their new book, Atmospheres of Violence, Structuring Antagonism and the Trans Queer Ungovernable, which was just published by Duke University Press. Eric E. Stanley is an associate professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. In collaboration with Chris Vargas, they directed the films Homotopia in 2006 and Criminal Queers in 2019. Eric is also an editor, along with Tourmaline and Joanna Burton, of Trapdoor, Transcultural Production and the Politics of Visibility, which was published by MIT Press in 2017. And with Matt Smith, they edited Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment and the Prison Industrial Complex, published by AK Press in 2011, and then with a new edition in 2015. Today in our chat, we talk about racialized violence against trans and queer people as a foundational part of the modern U.S. state. We trace this in the history of the formation of the settler state and how it persists today. We also discuss the improvised ways that trans and queer people learn and share survival tactics and thrive under these conditions in order to envision a new world.
Anarchist and anti-fascist prisoner Daniel Baker, who was convicted of transmitting threats while calling for anti-racists to show up in Tallahassee and stop the possible Trumpist coup, received 44 months in prison and 3 years of probation. His legal defense is appealing and will be re-airing an interview with his support crew soon. Meanwhile, there's an article that's really good by Natasha Leonard in The Intercept on the outcome of the case, and we wanted to let you know that Dan has just been transferred to FCI Memphis in Tennessee. You can write him and send him books at Daniel Baker, number 25765-509, FCI Memphis, P.O. Box 34550, Memphis, Tennessee 38184.
USA!
Know that he cannot receive photos or colored envelopes. You can find his book wish list, plus a bunch of other info, by visiting prisonersolidarity.com and searching his name, which is a great resource. If you're in the Asheville area, just a reminder that Blue Ridge ABC will be hosting a letter writing at West Asheville Park on the first Sunday of December, which is the 5th. Only this time it's from 3 to 5 p.m. so as to be able to handle available natural light a little better. If you're looking for more anarchist perspectives, check out episode number 50 of the A Radio Network's Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World. This November 2021 episode of our monthly offering from the A Radio Network features a shortened version of our talk with ASP, updates from Frequenza in northern Germany about the situation at the Belarusian and Polish border, as well as workers' struggles in Germany at Domino's Pizza. Elephant in the Room from Dresden features updates on repression and resistance in Belarus. A Radio Berlin shares an interview on the racist police killing of migrant Georgios Zantiotis in a Wuppertal jail cell and the resulting protests. And Chernoluknia from Ljubljana talks about the refugee situation in the Western Balkans. This episode and more can be found at a-radio-network.org.
My name is Eric Stanley. I use they, them pronouns. I live, work, and organize in various capacities in San Francisco, California.
I'm super excited to get to talk to you, and specifically we're talking about your recently published book, Atmospheres of Violence. And before getting into the argument specifically, I just wanted to acknowledge and appreciate that you publish a book with an academic press, Duke University Press, that's very explicitly anti-state and anarchist aligned, and that I find unique, remarkable, exciting. So I was just wondering if you wanted to talk at all about your experience as someone working within academia taking an anti-state position, because I've had a lot of pushback. I've been in and out of universities, And it's not always like a very safe place to be explicitly radical, or there's like a limited amount of like symbolic radicalism that you can do. So I just was wondering if you had any ideas on how you take that position up.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question, one that people usually don't ask me, so it made me think a lot. So as you might know, I published the first book that I edited, Captive Genders, on AK Press. So I've worked with them a lot over the years. And I published this one on Duke because, you know, one of the little secrets about having an academic job, if you don't publish on an academic press, you get fired and then you can never work in the University of California system for the rest of your life. So there's that part of it, the materiality of, you know, this is what you have to do. But that being said, my editor at Duke, Elizabeth Ault, has been incredibly supportive since the beginning of the project. There's never been any pushback from her, and I feel like she's done a really good job kind of protecting the project in terms of my vision and my politics and my theoretical commitments. So I appreciate that. And then in the larger question of the academy, and I think for me, I somewhat fly below the radar. Like, I'm just this small person in this huge institution. And luckily, they generally are not paying a lot of attention to me. So that is definitely to my benefit. When the introduction to the book did come out, though, the alt-right started like doing all these screen caps of it, and it got very big in this weird like alt-right way. And then they started emailing me and emailing my job and trying to get me fired and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, that being said, I mean, I think you're exactly right, right? The university itself is a fundamentally right-wing institution. You know, there's some people that can do okay stuff, but to me, it's also, you know, I always think about it in terms of, it's the place that steals my labor. It's not a thing that I heavily identify with. It's my job that I go to. Sometimes I can do interesting things there. I get to, you know, I really like working with students and I get to learn from, you know, interesting colleagues, but it's not like a central part of my understanding of myself. And I think that allows me to be like, okay, it's just that thing over there. And then I leave there. And, you know, my organizing oftentimes hasn't actually crossed over. And, you know, my organizing life is pretty separate. And I think that has been important to me as well. All of that being said, you know, I'm sure it's coming for me any moment. So I think it's always a matter of time. It's not really if, it's always when. So,
yeah. Well, I hope you can continue to use the resources that it gives you to do the work you're doing. And you do, I mean, in the book to bring, I mean, it, you know, it seems, I guess, as you're saying, distinct from like, maybe your personal organizing, but you're bringing that perspective into a theoretical academic work, which I think is really important, because a lot of the time the theory is so far away from any kind of like street level grassroots movement. So I guess one of the things that I've thought was really important in your argument is that it's specifically taking a stance against the state. And so given that, and then we're like talking within an anarchist, you know, radio show and podcast, I was wondering how you define the state in its workings of power, but also as an object of our like countering our political movements. And like, I guess also if you want to talk a little bit about one of the things that I found really important in your book is how you highlight the incoherence of the state and also the way that we reproduce its logic. So yeah, I was just, if you want to talk a little bit about the state.
Yeah, another incredibly big question, but it also is really important. So for me, the way that I think about the state is I think I call it something like a collective projection, meaning that the state is not something fundamentally external to us, right? It's the collective we. And, you know, that's both good news and bad news. And I mean, I think, you know, we have the ability to radically transform it the way it transforms us, perhaps end it. But we also must be accountable to the ways that we allow it to continue. So that also seems really important to me. Like, you know, there is a certain kind of critique within anarchist thought or anti-statism or whatever you might want to call it that always assumes that the state is something, you know, external, that we have no accountability for its violence. And I actually think we have to make ourselves account to that continuing violence under the name of stopping it. So I think that that's why that configuration is really important. And then I also think about the collective projection of the state being its totality is useful because it also helps us understand the way that we're constantly reproducing it, right? You know, it's not only the cops in our heads, but the state itself is in our head. And so this is not to say that, like, you know, the murderous institution of the state is not real and that, you know, we don't all equally have to be accountable for its violence, right? But I am interested in why and how we continue to allow it to exist, right? So on the question of the incoherence of the state form, right, there's this other kind of simplistic story that oftentimes gets told that the state is some kind of external force that just bears down upon us. And if that were true, it would actually be much easier to fight, right? And so that's why I argue about, argue that we must understand its radical incoherence as indeed its, you know, vicious fortitude. And again, that allows, which is also to say, mandates that we have a much more nuanced understanding of the relationship between the collective we and something that we imagine to be external, like the state.
Yeah, that's really helpfully laid out. And, you know, I'm thinking about what you're saying now sort of in terms of the way, like, us and, like, you know, anti-authoritarian, anti-state movements relate to the state as something we're, like, fighting. Because, like, on the one hand, you know, you talk about how we reproduce the state every day just in our, like, relationships, but I'm going to refer to a tweet that I saw you made recently, which is that we're not making, it's not that our demands are too little, that we need to demand more. And in a way, I feel like I really thought that was an important point, because, like, when we temper our demands, it's like we give the state too much power in some way. That's how I was understanding it. I don't know if you want to kind of jump off there at all and thinking about how we can, like, fight the state in a way that's not just, like, always on the back foot reacting to its incoherence and then, like, narrowing our horizons because it feels so impossible.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and right, this is obviously deeply in conversation with prison abolitionist thought and organizing as well. I mean, I actually see them as fundamentally the same project, even though people definitely disagree with that. But for me, one of the ways that the state, like, one of the forms of violence that the state takes is in that, you know, radical narrowing of our dreams, our demands, our wants, our desires, right? It always forces us to ask for less and be happy with nothing. Right. And again, that's not necessarily like that. That's why I think the internalization of the state, that kind of analysis is so important, because that's actually something that we're doing for the state. Right. Right. Even before they say no, you know, if we're going to think of it as something external, we're already saying no to ourselves and to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, OK. So also the thing that you like kind of fit within the scope of your, like, analysis is democracy, which again I think is something that gets so, you know, it's like it's an under analyzed over sort of suggested, like, answer to all the problems. I know in an anarchist milieu it's often something that we're critical of, but I wonder if you had any thoughts about how
can we can let go of democracy as, like, this ubiquitous solution to our problems? Like, more democracy is going to solve the problem.
Yeah. So the code of the book really thinks about this question, and I end with a bunch of, you know, open ideas. So it's not incredibly definitive. But something that led me there was, you know, was thinking about what is democracy, right? If it's something that both allegedly the left and the right argues over, then what is its substance, right? And oftentimes the argument is, like you're saying, the left will say, oh, the state's not democratic enough. And the right is saying, like, oh, it's too democratic. So one of the things that I'm interested in asking throughout the text is, you know, what is this idea of democracy? How is it enabling our more radical dreams for freedom or liberation, right? Why is this thing that we're holding on to, or how is this thing that we're holding on to also holding us down? And of course, that's not, you know, I'm not you know, drifting towards some sort of totalitarian dream. So I'm, you know, just to be clear, that's not the direction I'm going, because I think that, you know, democracy is so open, right? It's a placeholder that collects up a lot of different things. And so some formations of it, yes, definitely, but other formations of it are in and of itself already a kind of totalitarian regime. And so, you know, I'm interested in pulling apart the kind of steady understanding that we have of it, or that we think that we have of it, that we're all thinking about the same ideas and the same concept. And also how that is one of the ways that the state disciplines us, right? Through this, like, you know, the demand of democracy and as a kind of future-oriented project that we can never quite achieve, right? It's always the democracy to come and it's never here. And one of the things I ask is, what if it's already here, right? And what if instead of, you know, an imperfect democracy, what if its imperfection is indeed the system itself?
Yeah. And that, I mean, I guess that really ties into like the sort of central argument of your, as it relates to trans and queer life, which is like, if I'm gonna kind of try to encapsulate it, that racialized anti-trans and queer violence is a necessary expression of the liberal state, not a fault that will be reformed away, or like the violence that trans and queer people experience is a fundamental part of the atmosphere that we live in, using your term. So I guess if you could, you elaborate a little bit on like this sort of understanding of how queerness and transness relate to the state and violence, and also where you see transness, queerness, opening a horizon for liberatory struggle?
Sure. So, I mean, the book, as you just articulated, is an extended meditation or grappling with what I understand to be the fact of violence, which is to say that it's not, you know, an aberration of the state form, but indeed is one of its foundations. And so to me, what that means is that, you know, the way that we commonly are taught to think about violence is that, especially like violence directed at specific populations, for example, here, trans and queer and gender nonconforming people, is that it's just the work of, you know, a few bad apples or a few bad actors or whatever metaphor you want to use, directed at specific people. And what I do by paying, you know, close attention to the scenes of violence, which are really horrible, is I try to build out an analysis that understands that, you know, those specific actions as but an ambassador for a larger, you know, murderous culture. And, you know, for me, that is incredibly important because, you know, in the final instance, the book, of course, is deeply invested in ending these scenes of violence, right? But, you know, I don't allow myself or the theoretical tools that I use to rely on the state, of course, you know, something like the police or any other iteration of the any other facet of the state as remedy to that violence. And so then the question is, what is to be done, right? You know, what can we do? And of course, there's many other ways to think about this, but I think centering the question of the state itself is necessary. Otherwise, we're caught in this feedback loop, right, where we just keep, you know, at best addressing specific instances without radically destroying the world that mandates them. And I think that that is the necessary move that we have to make.
Yeah. In that, I mean, you take, you, in the book, you really pull from Fanon and his theorizing of you know, anti-colonial struggle. And so I'm wondering about violence, too, on the part of liberation. You say, I want to quote you, you talk about violence as a generalized field of knowledge that maintains this collective undoing lived as personal tragedy of those lost to modernity, speaking specifically about racialized trans and queer people who are subject to this kind of violence. But you also place violence as a tactic within our struggle. So I was wondering where you see it on our side as a way of like getting free.
Sure. So, I mean, the primary figure that I think with throughout the book is probably Frantz Fanon. You know, and he allows for many things, and among them is, you know, a reconceptualization of the time of violence, like, right, when does it end, when does it begin? And I argue that the scene does not begin or end with an individual attack, but constitutes the very possibility of that altercation in the first instance, right? And so we've already kind of repositioned the temporality of violence. I think that that's where we have to begin. You know, Fanon, you know, of course, we know, you know, argued that revolutionary violence was a necessary it was a necessary precondition under the state of total war that was racialized colonial occupation, right? So that's, you know, something that a lot of people know about Fanon. And so for him, in the first instance, we could not, you know, quote unquote, reject violence when it is already here, right? And so again, it's repositioning our relationship to the very question, right? And so for me, you know, I'm interested in thinking about how we might respond to not escalate that harm, but also, you know, under a commitment to ending it in a much more structural way than the way that we're thinking about it now. Right. And so that, you know, that's why I'm always thinking with and sometimes beside Fanon on this question, because it's so incredibly fruitful the way that he articulates it.
Yeah, that's a really helpful way of thinking about kind of the method of analysis that you bring to the book. And I mean, the book is difficult to read for multiple reasons, like one of the main ones being that it really involves in this archive of anti-trans and queer violence. And then each chapter is structured around specific events that you talk about. And, you know, you talk about what it means to, you know, describe the violence and trying not to reproduce the power operations that are undergirding it, even while trying to use your analysis to end it. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about how you feel you're able to engage with this horrific genocidal archive of you know, daily trans and queer violence in the United States, while not feeding into that, but also like what you say, like kind of reading from the perspective of struggle, because I feel like this would be an intervention into that time of violence from the point of view of like ending it, right, as you're saying.
Yeah, so I think that this is one of the, you know, again, another open question that I sit with throughout the text. And I think for me, you know, that place of ambivalence is not a place of knowing or not knowing, but indeed is a kind of theoretical commitment to, you know, being in the time of antagonism, right? And so I never know in advance, like, should I, you know, how should I narrate this? How can I be as careful as possible? How can I be as precise as possible without a kind of empty re-traumatization just for the sake of re-traumatization? Because we all know that that's not useful for anybody. And related, you know, not engaging with the archive is another form of violence, right? And so, you know, looking and looking away are both equally tied up in the totality of its scene, right? And so none of us can assume to be pure subjects outside of it, right? And so then what I attempt to do is, you know, again, go slowly, you know, think with people that are both survivors and not, pay really close attention to the language that they're using, how they're experiencing their own life, how they're theorizing their own life, right? And so for me, it's about not using people's really horrific events as kind of simple analogies or as examples, but indeed I argue that they're theorizing all the time. And you know, does it work? Does it not work? I don't know. But I, you know, that's as close as I could get. Again, because I think not, you know, I don't show graphic pictures in the book. You know, and I do, when I do narrate things, I try to go slowly through it and I try to talk about why I'm doing it and why I'm making certain choices and I'm not making other choices, right? Sometimes survivors say, like, this is what happened to me and I want everyone to know. And so in a certain sense, that allows us a little bit more space, but I actually think in the larger scheme of things, it doesn't really, right? We're still in that scene, even if a survivor wants something specific. Yeah. And so I think I'm just trying to hold all those contradictions at the same time and, you know, push them to the front as opposed to hiding them.
Yeah. I mean, it really comes through to me. I mean, as you were talking about the people who are involved in these experiences being like, you know, theorizing them themselves. I mean, you don't have a kind of hierarchy of who produces knowledge in your book, which is also, I think, unique from an academic perspective, which really does separate, like, you know, the people that are being described from the people doing the analysis. So you, like, you locate, you know, trans theory in the lived lives of trans people, no matter what their educational backgrounds are. And I think, I mean, I guess, like, you know, one thought I had is that this, like, so-called trans tipping point that we're past now, right, like, brought into representation, specifically, I think, Black trans women in a different way than had been before. But I really feel like it goes hand in hand with a kind of, both on, like, the reactionary right and on the left, sort of spectacularization of the violence that Black trans women experience that feels like, you know, at best, useless, at worst, like, harmful. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts, like, you know, beyond this, like, how, I don't know what your thoughts are, just like how to work to keep Black trans women alive, right? And not relating to Black trans women as victims, and like, yeah, how, what kind of work we can do right now to support them.
I mean, I think obviously always asking people what they want and need is where we always start. But I think to your point is incredibly important, right? Because you know, historically, and right now, at the beginning of the book, I think a lot about Marsha P. Johnson and the way that she was exiled from, you know, mainstream or even radical leftist lesbian and gay culture in the 1970s through the time of her death, actually. And now she's kind of been brought back in as a trans of color or Black trans woman activist ideal. And I make an argument that both of those are violent in and of themselves. So, like, one of them is not the remedy for the other one, because the way in which she is brought into the archive doesn't disturb the coloniality of the archive itself. All it is a kind of accommodation, not for the politics that Marsha was invested in throughout her life, but indeed to actually support a white supremacist state. And so that is really important, because I think, as you're also, I mean, what I'm also hearing in this question is the ways in which trans women of color get emptied out of content or of politics, and they just become a screen upon which all kinds of people just project a whole lot of things onto them. And so I think that it is all of our tasks then to, again, understand, for example, Marsha as a theorist, and to read what she wrote and to listen to the words that she said, as opposed to just, you know, projecting our contemporary analysis on top of her as an empty subject of history.
Yeah. That really, like, gels it for me, because, like, I mean, in the way that, like, you know, even leftists or radicals or whatever can reproduce a sort of anti-Blackness, I feel like often Black trans women are brought into a conversation as if they're already victims and not brought and not included actually in the conversation as the theoreticians that you're, like, showing them to be, you know, in certain spaces. Obviously, it's not everywhere. But since you mentioned Marsha P. Johnson, one thing that I see you doing in this book is kind of, like, intervening in the history of, you know, the history of, like, gay liberation, trans liberation, queer liberation, whatever movements, and also, like, the way that relates to queer theory. And, you know, like, I think early on what was really exciting about the movement, and what still I think resonates with people today, is this thought that trans and queer people in themselves are, like, revolutionary in the ways that they live and love and fuck, you know? But, like, that didn't really stop from the assimilationist sort of arm sort of, like, being the main kind of focus of a gay rights movement. And then I see, like, in the university with queer theory, how, like, queerness gets sort of theorized away through power, but then divorced from the actual work and, like, even the living. I think this, like, is particularly true after, like, the kind of heyday of ACT UP. But now I'm seeing more crossover, I think, of movement work and academic knowledge production. So I was just wondering, like, if you had anything to say about the inheritance of a sort of, like, radical queer legacy, but also, like, where you see your works kind of situated within that inheritance and the, like, location of knowledge production of the academy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, a number of things. So I think that I'm always interested in the ways that politics or post-political regimes of intelligibility congeal more so than identities, right? And I say this all the time, an identity is not a politic. San Francisco has many, many a trans police officer. So I also always say that San Francisco is the laboratory of neoliberalism. Any awful thing will always be developed here in terms of multicultural white supremacy. And so, I study it because I live it. And that is also to say that all of that analysis is, of course, all of that comes from organizing, right? Street-based organizing. And another thing that I'm always, careful to say is that, anything that I have to say that might be useful in this text comes from those worlds, right? Comes from the worlds that, have taught me so much in collective anti-authoritarian or anarchist spaces. So I want to foreground that. And then also in terms of the specific moment that we're in with, scholarship, I guess, in the academy, I think that there is this kind of turn back towards the kinds of political questions that were not as readily apparent as they were before. And that can be both good and bad, right? Because I'm also interested in what gets constituted as political and what doesn't. And oftentimes the things that I think are most useful are things that are not on the surface actually quote unquote political. And then the really messy problematic ones are the quote unquote political text. So, you never know what you're going to get. But I do think that, this book in particular, it's kind of interesting. I mean, it hasn't been out that long, but it is interesting where it gets taken up and where it doesn't. I mean, I don't know if it LGBT study stuff will really engage with it. I don't know. I don't really know how that will shake out. I mean, I hope so. I hope people look at it, I guess. But, I'm not sure what forms that will take yet. Yeah. So I think that I have a whole bunch of open questions, but, towards the point of identity again, I think I explicitly say this in the book, is that I don't have anything definitive to say about LGBT or otherwise trans or queer people. I'm not actually making an argument about people. I'm making an argument about formations of vitality or generativity or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
The File Scrawl Radio is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
You're listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and this is my conversation with Eric Stanley, author of Atmospheres of Violence, Structuring Antagonism and the Trans Queer Ungovernable, published this year by Duke University Press. Maybe a way to rephrase what I was trying to get at is that the early gay liberation, if you read a lot of the texts, there's this imagination that the revolution is at hand, and part of it has to do with gay life, right? Cruising is revolutionary or whatever. And then that doesn't happen, right? That revolution doesn't happen. But then you see this certain kind of, I feel like, you get to Lee Edelman's version of queer theory in No Future, where he's queerness is the death drive of society, is a taking up of that same kind of view that queerness is disruptive in some kind of inherent way. Although it's different at this point, what he's talking about, than the gay liberation front or our street transvestite action revolutionaries. Yeah. I guess how do you understand queer and trans? There's one thing that you described that I don't think I've ever seen anyone write about in this way, and I thought it was so important, is that we can get slurred at in the wrong way, and yet it's still correct in some some manner, right? Because there's some way that you say we signify it differently. So that's like a specific kind of visibility that can be wrong and right at the same time. So I don't know if you have a way of like talking about how maybe you define trans and queer, or like the like location that we live in.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're getting at. I mean, I do this. I can only think about it through negation, because I can't think of any kind of prescriptive identity, because it's always going to fail. And so for me, trans and queerness is a kind of retroactive reading practice that can only be known after, like kind of after an identity or an event unfolds. But like you're saying, one of the things that I find really interesting is that, you know, I'm not deeply tethered to the idea of identity itself, and yet the world is constituted through identity, right? I'm always interested, you know, at the same time we have these radical critiques of, you know, the impossibility to know trans and queerness as a, you know, totalizing or generalizing force. Nonetheless, I walk down the street and someone knows that better than I know myself. And so that is really interesting. Like, what is it then, right? Like, and that to me is why I think about anti-trans and queer violence as a kind of general field of knowledge, or an epistemology of violence, because of that everywhere and nowhere-ness that it simultaneously inhabits.
Yeah, I guess like building on that then, do you want to talk a little bit about how you see sort of this disruption, this projection, this negation that gender and sexuality goes hand in hand with the process of racialization that has occurred specifically in the U.S. context through the capture and enslavement of Africans? Yeah, like how does race, gender, sexuality get forged historically as these systems of domination? Because that's a huge part of what you're talking about in the book.
Yeah, so I mean, and I think sometimes, because it is what the book is about, and so sometimes I forget to make it so explicit. So just to be clear, I'm not actually, I'm never talking about everyone that quote unquote might identify as LGBT, right? That's like a useless category for me. And indeed, I also make explicit that many people that identify under those terms that have access to normative power vis-a-vis white supremacy, ableism, class, other axes of difference, know very little in the materiality of their life about the forces of violence. So, you know, I'm not making this like equal distribution argument. That being said, you know, my book takes as kind of axiomatic that chattel slavery and settler colonialism are, you know, at least in this nightmare of the United States, the primary scenes of gender normativity's concretization, mm-hmm. right? And so I don't believe that we can ever do quote-unquote queer trans theory without, you know, a deep engagement with both of those as ongoing practices and indeed not simply facts of history, right? So I'm not interested in, like, you know, how gender and sexuality, you know, took form in slavery as if it's something that happened then and isn't constantly happening now, right? And so then, you know, an attention to the settler state and its, you know, anti-Black idiom is fundamental if we are ever going to attempt to begin to open up the questions of gender, sexuality, transness, queerness, etc., right? So they can never be separated.
Right. I wonder if you know, like the way that you talk about this, you know, and the lineages of like Black feminism that you pull on, I think specifically like of how Hortense Spillers talks about the kind of ungendering of Black female flesh as a site of a potential insurgent ground. And to me, that always rings in a certain like trans way. And I mean, like C. Riley Snorton also kind of builds off that too. A lot of people do. So like, again, I guess I'm returning to another theme, but like, how do you see this situation that like often gets narrated as a place of like complete domination and violence, also as a place for like reshaping, destroying the world that we live in now and reshaping it in a way that would be, you know, let people live?
I mean, definitely. I mean, I always include Hortense Spillers' work as fundamental to whatever might constitute itself as trans theory, right? And that, you know, people like you're saying, people like Riley and many others do this as well. And I think that it's definitely the right move. At least for me, she opened up so many of these questions and continues to do that work. So, but yeah, I mean, thinking with her theorization of the insurgent ground, we also know that, like, kind of along with the structuring horrors that in their epistemological force that were and are chattel slavery, there are always moments of people fighting back, right? And so one of the arguments that I make is that even within a totality, there's still possibility, right? And that might seem kind of contradictory, and it is. It's structurally contradictory because a totality can't have that. But I still think that that's actually how the world works. And it's also the version of the world that I want to hold on to, again, under the name of ending it so that we might build one that we can survive. Right. And I don't see that as a kind of linear teleological process, but indeed a kind of simultaneity of, you know, action, theorization, revolt, revision, all happening at one time. And I think that is already happening. And so then one of our goals is to, you know, hold up those moments where we can see it so that it might open up possibility for others.
Yeah. Do you think this ties in any way to, or could we tie this in a positive way to the incoherence that you're talking about, like that power works through in the state? Because on the one hand, that makes it so that it's hard to know how to react or we get caught just reacting, but also it means that it isn't coherent and therefore like already over, right?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I think about this all the time, just in like actual organizing terms or whatever. Like, we never know what's going to set something off. Like, we just have no idea. Like, we can make all these strategies and theorizations and think we have a plan for it, and then it goes so sideways, and it can either like open up radical possibility or shut down everything, right? And we just don't know. And I think that is because of the state's radical incoherence. And so then, you know, I think that we need a kind of, you know, again, it's not a kind of prescriptive politic, but a way of thinking about that. That of course is always a plan for action in relation to it, but also beyond it, right? So it's not a simple, you know, constant reaction to the state, which is oftentimes what we're tied up in, and that's one of the ways that the state disciplines us, right? And that we're accepting that discipline through the constant reaction. And I understand sometimes we have to do that, and that just is the materiality of living in this awful world. But that being said, you know, that's not all of it, and that's also not all of what we're doing. And so, you know, I'm always looking towards those like spaces of hyper marginality where things that don't look, you know, explicitly political, but to me are actually giving me life, giving me possibility. The things that actually help me go on in the world are, you know, these really small moments that oftentimes gets passed over.
Yeah. My mind went to something that was like very explicitly political, but maybe, I don't know, something I keep thinking about is, and maybe you have some thoughts on this, like last year, the pandemic hits and I'm like, okay, here's like, we're going to be met with the incoherence of our lives, the contradictions of like being forced to work or not to work and pay your bills or whatever. And I was like, some kind of revolt will happen. And it didn't happen, I think, until George Floyd uprising. And I don't want to take away the like specificity of the George Floyd uprising, but I think that something is connected between the way that that was generalized outside of like Minneapolis and the work that people were doing in response to COVID, even though that maybe wasn't as visible in the moment as like a, you know, a riot or something like that. And then, yeah, I don't know. I'm just kind of going off the cuff here, but I feel like that also points to sort of the underpinning like racial components of like COVID that don't get talked about very often. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. That was just sort of me thinking about what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, of course we're in a settler state, so, you know, COVID's going to be an explicitly anti-Black and otherwise racist in terms of its impact, like, you know. So I do think that that's always important to say. And I think it's also, for me, like I would like to pretend like I'm an accelerationist, but I just like have no evidence that that's ever true. You know, I'm like, oh, now that, because it actually is like a kind of safe place to be. You're like, oh, all we have to do is like everything will get so bad, it'll just get, and it's like, no, it just gets worse. Like, that's, you know, that's one thing I learned with getting older. You're like, nope. Whatever, you know, you start, and I think it's interesting in thinking about the incoherence of the state, because then you're always longing for things you never wanted in the first place. And that's a trip, right? When you're like, oh, the good old days when they're, you know, whatever, bad thing. I mean, think about that with gentrification too, when you start longing the things that you used to hate because at least they're not as bad as the things that are now. And yeah, so I think that, again, I think that the conditions, like, I think retroactively, we can maybe think about like why things pop off in certain times, but we also like can't prefigure that, right? Because sometimes all the same conditions are there and it just doesn't happen. And I think there's something about the generalized spontaneity of you know, the social world that can't be predicted and can't be corralled. And I think that that's actually really good and beautiful. But that said, you know, we also shouldn't live in a world that has to constantly respond to, you know, the unmitigated, unending anti-Black violence that is leveled against Black people and, you know, all the time, everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I guess to sort of return to more specifically to the book, like in that light, you know, we were talking about racialized gender, but also you kind of pull from a sort of like, I guess, like Sylvia Winter influenced idea that all of the kind of violence that we see that's gendered, sexualized, racialized is tied completely to the ideas of humanity and modernity. And you say that the racialized trans and queer person rests at the limit of the modern and of the human and is necessary to maintain the lie of those projects, sort of through being endlessly disciplined and killed. So I wonder if, like, I mean, you also, I guess this comes out really clearly in your analysis of suicide, and I don't know if you want to talk about that, but I really love this line that you say, trans queer suicide reads the world for the filth it is, because it puts it pretty boldly to me. What you're talking about here, but yeah, so I wonder if you want to talk about how the concepts of modernity and humanity come in to your analysis of like sort of the regulation of and killing of trans queer life.
Sure. So throughout the text, I kind of intentionally slip between the settler state, modernity, and enlightenment humanism. And again, I'm not saying that they're all the same thing, but I think together they gather up and they also help name these tendencies of recurrence that we inherit in our contemporary moment, right? So they're all doing something a little bit differently, but they all like help me name something, right? And so if the human is that which can stand before the law and make claims as its proper subject, right? That's like the kind of traditional understanding of the figure of the human. Then it also needs its double, right? Its constitutive outside to maintain its stability. Right. And so this is a very like common figure in Black feminist thought and also in critical theory. Right. The constitutive outside is that which constitutes the human. And then those that are subjugated to the limit then become limit concepts, and they kind of police the border, the inside outside. And they're necessary. They're like actually the major figures in terms of the schema. And this is, again, Fanon. So it's the same thing, essentially. And so, you know, I think that is so compelling because of the specific forms of violence that I'm thinking about, right? It's not just about exiling people, but it's about a kind of incorporative inclusion where people are both forced out and brought in at the same time. So again, we can think about this with TERFs. Like, TERFs are so fascinated. Like, they spend way more time thinking about gender than I do, a gender professor. You know what I mean? It's like, it's fascinating. I'm like, you are obsessed. And so I think that same formation is actually incredibly useful, right? Because that's the form of phobic attachment that I'm interested in, right? So it's, again, a kind of inclusive incorporation where it's both pushing things out and bringing things in. And that's actually a really horrifically violent formation to be caught in, right? It's way worse than just exile, because you're like shuttled in between the inside outside in a scene of total war. And so for me, that ties into this figure of the human as, again, the subject of modernity, right? And so then the constitutive outside is this, that structure is what I'm naming as the limit concept. And it's, you know, that's a very like theoretical way of saying it. But it thinking about that in relationship to the chapter that I have on suicide, you know, that chapter is important to me because one of the things that I try to do in it is depathologize people that are pushed to the limit while also wanting to keep people alive, right? So it's not like a kind of nihilistic where I'm like, this is a jouissance or something like that. I'm like, this is actually horrific and I want it to stop. But I also know that we have to stop gaslighting people into recreating this narrative that this is an individual choice and that this person alone was pushed to the limit, when indeed the world is pushing people to the limit, right? The everydayness, the like of, you know, racist, transphobic, homophobic, ableist violence is indeed the force that's pushing them there. It's not a kind of self, you know, what Fanon calls auto-destruction is never really about the person themselves. It's about the way in which they're positioned in a deadly world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm sort of like at a loss for, I think that's really important the way that you talk about that, because you can get so lost in sort of like the individual situation to sort of erase the like right. commonplace right. experience that precedes it for someone who's being like harassed their whole life for just being. I wanted to ask you about representation and aesthetics, because like, I mean, you have this really interesting analysis of a surveillance film, and in that you're kind of going through like the filmic image itself, and talking about how sort of dominant aesthetics are grounded in anti-blackness and anti-queerness, not even just how it's represented, but in the structure of representation. And like in your arguments about the specific acts of violence that you are reading, like the violence goes beyond the like immediate moment. But then you also like, importantly, I think make room for like queer, trans, radical art and like life as a kind of aesthetic. So I wonder if you talk about a little bit about anti-blackness, anti-queerness in aesthetic production, but also the rooms for alternative visions and use of like different media.
Yeah. So, I mean, that chapter I'm thinking a lot with people like David Marriott and his work on racial fetishism, anti-blackness, and the moving image itself. Also, Fanon helps us think about this question. Sylvia Winter and, a bunch of other people. So, but for me, representation is always a double bind, right? So it's that which brings us into the world and that which brings us out of the world. You know, I also am a filmmaker. I like films. I understand the way that they literally build a world and they don't just represent one. So it's not as if I'm like arguing for a kind of, you know, I don't know, representational austerity or something like that as the revolutionary possibility of the world. Like, that sounds horrible. And so like, no to that. And on the other hand, I know that, you know, quote unquote, positive representation is the thing that is most easily given to us by the settler state, right? We demand free housing, free healthcare, free education, free whatever it is. And they're like, oh, here's a, you know, trans sidekick on a TGIF show, right? And so, you know, one of the things that I always say is that whatever is the thing that they're most ready to give us is the thing that we actually don't need. And so, you know, it's, again, holding that contradiction, because I know that representation, again, constitutes the world. And yet it doesn't only do that. And so, you know, that chapter in particular thinks about formalism, right? Conversations around transness and blackness, sometimes are more interested in the kind of narrative depiction of the image. And, you know, I'm interested in that as well. But something that's more interesting to me is the formalism of the image itself, because one of the arguments that I make is that you actually don't need a kind of scene of anti-black, anti-transness on the image for both of those kind of twinned ideologies to be operative, right? And so, you know, it's kind of ironic. I turned back to a bunch of 1970s film theory, because they're actually thinking about formalism and structural film and things like that, that we don't do as much of now. But, you know, that seemed really important to me, because I'm trying to get at why changing towards quote unquote positive representation alone does not change material conditions, right? That's actually the question I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. I know. I was interested that you were quoting Christian Metz, because that was something from my early grad school days. But I mean, like when you were talking about Fanon's idea that violence precedes and like comes after that specific moment, you talk about him in the theater, right? And being like, just sitting in the theater is an anti-black situation, regardless of what the film is representing. And that makes me think, even just like, you know, post George Floyd uprising, the way that all the like media companies were doing black voices, and you could like still present supposedly, you know, Black Lives Matter content in an anti-black environment. But yeah, I could nerd out with you a little bit more on the formalism, but I kind of want to move to some of the stuff that you get to at the ending, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So one of the words that comes up, it's in the subtitle, and it's part of the coda, you know, that there's legacies of resistance, and you give this the name of ungovernable, like becoming ungovernable. You take it from the classification that, you know, certain queer youth get for their perceived social disruption. And then you also use the word sedition, which I was like really excited to see. So I'm wondering, like, I mean, I take it in my reading of your book that some of the stuff that's happening is a kind of clandestine survival. And maybe this goes back to like being, you know, not within the archive and not being represented. But like, I guess, what do you mean by ungovernable? What do you mean by like a queer sedition? How do we have this kind of survival? What kind of worlds does it build? Is it generalizable, or is it like, does it need to be like kind of under wraps all the time?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's generalizable, and I'm not sure if it's prescriptive, like if it can be a prescriptive project, right? It might be, again, something that can only be noticeable, you know, in the aftermath of it or something like that. I'm not totally sure. But I mean, ungovernability or becoming ungovernable is useful for me because it names a kind of non-space of being both a subject and an object simultaneously. And I think that it's actually how many people are forced to inhabit the world. So I think that it's generalizable in that reality. But I also think that because many of the practices are clandestine, like, I'm not interested in bringing them into representation outside of their specificity. Like, I'm not trying to narc people out. You know, I mean, I think about that a lot, like our relationship, like, what am I doing? And so, you know, I can only like nod towards things. Again, you know, I don't want to be hyper specific about them. But that being said, you know, those are some of the moments that are so deeply generative to trans and queer world making, you know, whether it's just, and I think it can be so incredibly small to something really large. It can be like, you know, when another trans person's working at the cafe and they give you your food for free, like, it's actually on those basic levels, and that how that changes the molecular structure of your body. Like, I actually think about that a lot. And unfortunately, that's becoming increasingly uncommon. It used to be more common in like the 90s, you know, when there weren't security cameras and whatever, all that kind of stuff everywhere. And you could just like give someone a free coffee, and now that person will like get taken to jail. And so, you know, I think that there's that, you know, I think that the examples that I use in the book are, Tourmaline has this really great film called The Personal Things, which is this really short stop motion animation film about Ms. Major. And it kind of narrates how she changed all of her gender markers, and then she changed them back again because she wanted to be recognized not as a cis woman, but indeed as a transgender person. And they wanted people to love her for that and to fuck all this other stuff. And to me, that moment is, I mean, it's also like changing state issued identification was actually much easier, like in a clandestine way, 25 years ago, because there weren't really massive computer systems, and there were just paper with a picture glued on it. And so I think about that as indeed another kind of way of resisting the biometric drive of the contemporary settler state, right? There's all these like kind of movements towards, you know, more gender options, which I think are fine, and, you know, different forms of biometric technology that are not predicated on gender. But I actually don't think that any of those are going to necessarily get us any closer to freedom in a kind of generalizable way. I understand, yes, they're things that people need to stay alive right now, and I always will support that, especially for people that are in hyper-institutionalized situations. So I always will, again, support that. But that being said, you know, I don't think that that can be the end of, as Tourmaline puts it, our freedom journey.
Emergency, emergency.
We obey the one. We're gonna exterminate you now. We will get our power. We obey the one. We are the superior being.
Daleks, listen to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Since we've been talking about it for over a year, and you probably already know anyway, we've decided not to say it this time. So we're not going to tell you again that to protect yourself from COVID-19, you should wash your... And we certainly won't repeat once more that you should wear a... Or most importantly, that we must keep our... From others. Because you already know this is the best way to fight the virus. Even when you're vaccinated, let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
You need quality sounds? Tune into CKUT 90.3 on the frequency modulation band radio. www.ckut.ca